Welcome to the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast, taking you around the country, shedding light on the work of the Scottish FA from grassroots to coach development, and taking a look at the future of our game.
In this episode, Stephen McManus, Steve Keane, Brian McLaughlin.
Good to see you all, and good to see everyone in the numbers there. I think we've got the full complement of the course in, so we'll get started, guys. This is one of my favourite parts, certainly, of the week. Getting to pick on these guys' brains, and we've certainly got a good few questions that have been set out from everyone on the course today. So, in actual fact, this is our last Q&A session. So, not only do the people on the course listen in, or they set the questions and, of course, listen in to what the tutors have said all week, but we also pass this to the kind of coaching workforce, if you like, through our podcast series. So it's always good to let those guys know that are listening in that this is actually our final one. I think we've done three A licenses, three B licenses, and now this is our second youth license during the past 7 months. So we've certainly done quite a bit, but this will be our last in our series of the Q&A. I always like to start the Q&A sessions, guys, with a kind of COVID catch-up. I don't think things have necessarily changed too much. Stephen, I'll start with you. You and I have spoke a bit on the phone recently over the last couple of weeks. You're back training, but still some difficulties in getting games organised and things like that.
Yeah, there's difficult situations, Greg, that's happening obviously throughout the kind of world, and we are, the football world's no different. The positive for us is that our boys are training. They've been training in a safe environment through the challenges that the club have faced, but through the health protocols and whatnot, they're sticking by everything the best we possibly can to make sure that the lads are training at reserve level, which is great. We're there to facilitate and help the first team in whatever way we possibly can. So the boys have been absolutely terrific, and it's a great credit to everybody at the football club, to the measures of safety that they've went through.
Good, good. And Brian, performance schools are back. You maybe thought the international games were back. You thought you'd a couple of games against England, but that was mission aborted somewhere in the M1, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a mixed bag for myself, Greg. Performance schools are back, which is great, and the seven head coaches have done an unbelievable job in getting our programme as close to normal as possible. Me personally, I thought, yeah, I've got a game against the old enemy in England, and I thought this is superb. I made a magnificent decision by luck that we stayed in Scotland for the first few days rather than travelling down early, which allowed me to train four times over the 2 days.
Brilliant.
And then on the way down to England, yeah, just at Lancaster service station, I got the phone call to say, pull over at the next service station and then let all the staff know. And the 20 players know that, unfortunately, there's no game. The game has just been cancelled. So I understand the difficulty. I understand the challenges just now.
Yeah, it's tough.
And it's just the way we are. We're all in the same boat.
Absolutely, the way we are. And then, Steve, you've got your own story. You're sitting there in cold storage or self-isolation now for what you're in now, 6 or 7 days into a 14-day self-isolation period, having escaped to Perth. I wouldn't say not Perth in Scotland, by the way, but Perth in Australia, as you self-isolate out there before starting a job. And congratulations on your new job with Melbourne Victory.
Yeah, it's a strange one, Greg, because One hand, I'm really excited about the job, but I'm slightly frustrated because the players are actually started. They're on the pitch in Melbourne, but you know this country's policy is that when you fly in from anywhere in the world, you quarantine for 2 weeks. So I've got another 8 days to go. So I'm in a hotel, but I'm getting my session planners out. I've been looking on the Y Scout at our first opponents when we go and play in the Asian Champions League. So I've been busy. And then I've really enjoyed the course with the candidates this week. It's been superb. But I'm looking forward. I've got the butterflies in the belly again to get back on the pitch. They never leave you. And really excited about, accepting a new challenge and being with a big club out here in Australia.
No, absolutely. And good luck to you. You've been part of, I listed those three A licenses, three B licenses and two youth license courses that we've done online, or certainly the theoretical parts of it online, Steve. You've been part of them all. How's it been for you the past 7 months being so involved with this?
It's been great. And like we say, what's really refreshing for me is the different styles and the different ways that, even though we've got, a really nice framework in how we structure the sessions, sorry, the the concept of how to deliver the sessions on Zoom, it still gives people the freedom to start to see the different styles and how they're going to be when they get on the pitch. And that's always good, because like you always say in your start when you at the course, you know, we don't want robots. We want people with different personalities and different styles, you know, and it's always nice to see people approaching it slightly different. And you know, I've scrolled down so many notes. You know, I'm a big note taker, and you know, I'll be taking some of the examples that we've seen out of those 8 courses, and you'll see them on the pitch down in Melbourne very soon.
Brilliant, very good, very good. So I've had a look through the questions. All the course candidates, I think the 30 of them have all set us questions for today. Now, normally I would pick maybe the best 10 and we would maybe discuss that between the three of you, but I think I'll do it a little bit differently, as this is our last episode today, if you like. I think what we'll do is we'll do a kind of quick fire. You know, when you watch Question of Sport, the last round's always a quick fire round. So I think I'll just go round the questions. That I think we've got maybe about 24 questions that are decent. So that means you're getting 8 each, roughly, or we'll see how we go. So the first question is, and any one of you can pick this one up, I think. It's from Phil Gordon. It's for any of the panel. And he says, what's the biggest chance for you personally within youth development? Stephen, you're probably at the coalface of that on a day-to-day basis at this point in time.
Yeah, I would say... Oh, that's a good question, Greg. I'd say it depends how he means with the biggest chance as such. What does he kind of mean
biggest
by...
Biggest challenge.
What I would say, Greg, with the biggest challenge just now is, and certainly at reserve level, we find that the pathway from when you come out in under 18 into a first team is a difficult age group just now. Greg, for not just for us as a football club, for Scottish football in a whole, and you know, our feelings on it as a club and mine individually is about the benefit of having a coach team and competitive football. So can we expose our young players that are coming out of under 18 football into the men's competitive football as quickly and under our guidance as we possibly can? I think that would be a huge benefit. You see it in some of the countries abroad, and that's certainly something that we would love to see happening in the future.
Yeah, maybe it brings us quite nicely on to the next question from Ian Skinner. Brian, he just simply asked the question, winning versus development.
I genuinely believe in youth football. It's easier to win a game than it is to develop players. I've always believed that. So for me, it's always about development. And as soon as you when you get the development correct and you get it right, you'll start winning more games than you lose. And ultimately, you'll develop players for an A squad in my case, or you'll develop players for a first team in Steve's case, in Stephen's case. And when that happens, that's the result. That's you win when you see the players going up there and they're ready to become a first team player, not for one game or 5 games, for hundreds of games. That's when you know you've won. But unfortunately, you've got to wait years.
Yeah. Okay. I think there's a nice bridge there again into Dan Smith's question for you, Steve. Steve Keane, which do you find the most challenging or rewarding? Academy manager in youth development or first team level and results?
I think they're both challenging. I think they're both challenging and but they're both very different. I would say to Dan, you know, and obviously in the academy setup, your job is obviously to try and get as many as you can into the first team. And that gives you as the coach, when you see them moving up and training with the first team and then ultimately making their debut, that gives you so much pleasure and satisfaction. You know, when you know you find yourself in that environment, which I've done in many occasions, I'm always looking down to try and see, you know, because I feel as though I'm a youth developer even when I'm working with the first team.
Yeah.
So I'm always looking down and saying, what have we got in there? And, you know, probably reversing it sometimes when you're a academy manager or a youth coach, you're hoping the pathway's cleared. When I'm a first team coach or assistant manager or head coach, I'm always trying to think, you know, is there somebody in the academy? Is there somebody in our youth development department? Is there a young player that's potentially better than what we have here? I'm kind of backtracking and clearing the area. So I think they're two different jobs. Mm-hmm. I've done, you know, most of the jobs within a club, but I think you can link them, and I think they give you different, you know, different pleasures. But ultimately, you know, I'm a developer. It doesn't matter if I'm working with the first team or I'm working in the academy. I like the developing young players.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with that question, Stephen, and come to you, because Steve talked there about linking the two. You're right in the heart of that link, the way I see it, anyway, from reserves into first team and then from youth teams into the reserves as well.
Yeah, I think so. You know, certainly at our level, Greg, like you say, touched on working the reserve level, it's really important that players see a pathway. They see a pathway from the reserves into the first team, but also you see a pathway from the under-18s into the reserves, or from the under-16s into the under-18s, and there's got to be that clear and consistent pathway throughout the club. And if you have that, then there's that shining light that you will get up to the next level, and before you know it, you're developing through the ages. But I think what's also really important is that at first team level, they've got people that the young players can aspire to become. So when they, certainly at our club, you've got it with Callum McGregor and James Forrest, and obviously you had it with Kieran Tierney beforehand, where young players need role models. They need role models throughout the football club. So it becomes really important when the younger players see that there's these guys, the top international players that are in the first team. It gives them real hope and real belief that if they can do it, then the young players can be the one. And as our job as youth developers, we need to give the guys the platform to do that.
Yeah, I see the likes of Celtic and Rangers when they're in the Europa League last night, and the youth academies, you know, they tweet out, don't they? Because the Europa League gives them a unique opportunity as well, that they've got to have some youth players, and that gives them a unique opportunity to have on the bench. But as you rightly say, that gives everything the exposure then, and it gives the aspiration to the younger kids.
It does, and like I say, the young players need that, and also as coaches to it's brilliant when you see our young players, you see the buzz that they get from training with first team players, but also you can see the real belief that they then have when they go and train with the first team players. You can see that when they come, if they come back down with us at reserve level, you can see they've got that belief and the confidence, because they know that they're capable of going up and handling themselves at that level. And that, again, goes down to the hard work that the players have done throughout their careers. But also, it shows you the terrific work that the coaches have worked at, not just at reserve level, but from 9 years of age, from 10, 11, 12, throughout the academy. It's important that the coaches get, at that level, get the recognition they deserve as well.
Yeah, brilliant. Coming on to you, Brian, a question from Christian here. Is it better to have common game model? Is it better to have a common game model for the whole academy, or do you give more freedom to the coaches? That's maybe one in your performance schools. All your performance schools have got freedom to do their own sessions, or do you follow a national curriculum?
We follow a national structure, Greg. So I think it's... It depends on how we define game model, I think, really. So let me try and explain that. I think in our performance schools, we work to a national structure. But actually what happens on a daily basis is, being at the head of it, I don't need to go in and watch every single session that the seven guys are doing, because I totally trust them. And they believe in the model that we're trying to deliver, because we believe this is the best way of developing players. So we've got a structure, we've got a game model, we've got certain principles within it, and without doubt, we believe there's 10 habits that underpin the whole programme. That's more important for us than an actual model where you must do this session or you must do that session. I don't believe in that, because as coaches, you know, we all get educated as coaches, and we need to continuously develop as coaches. I think the only way you can do that is you've got to have a little bit of freedom in order to deliver the best way to get the message across. But there certainly needs to be some sort of a structure. I don't believe everyone can just do what they want. There needs to be a model and a structure behind everything.
Yeah, good stuff. Steve, we'll come to you from Mark Russell this time. How do you deal with personalities and egos coming from youth academies into the first team environment? Do they have much of an ego about them? You know, they've maybe been the big fish, if you like, in the academy, and then all of a sudden they get a hell of a knock as they come into that first team environment.
I think for the young players that's maybe been the you know, the up and coming star within the younger age groups coming into the first team. You hope that within the academy you've educated them enough to be confident, but don't be overconfident when you step into the first team environment. You're there and you want to be there to stay. And I think, you know, that if you've got an ego, I would like to think that an ego can be perceived in a slightly different way, which is a strong belief in your own ability that you're good enough. You know, and I've seen it sometimes where players have went up having what you would perceive as having no ego and really then suffered a little bit, you know, maybe went up and thought, you know, that they're not ready or they're not good enough to be there. So I think you need some type of belief in yourself, whether you want to call that an ego. You hope that it just manifests itself in a way that it comes across as, I'm good enough to be here, I'm confident enough here, I've done all my work, you know, I've done my development at a younger age group, I'm now ready. And you hope then that when they got, because the fact that they've went up, if you've had the scope to bring them up or to suggest to the first team manager or staff that they should be there, you hope they go and they grasp it. Sometimes you never know. Sometimes they go up for a few weeks and they wobble and they have to come back down. Sometimes they go up and they just fly. But I would rather not say ego. I would like to say that an ego of a young player going up is a big self-belief.
I think it's a good point you make, isn't it? At the end of the day, we've all got an ego. But I think traditionally the word ego has been constrained as a
negative.
As a bad word. It's a negative.
Yeah, exactly.
As you say, can be made a positive.
Of course, and you have to have that, I wouldn't say a swagger, but you have to have a belief that you can go up and you can get into a first team environment that's full of senior players and not be scared to be the youngest one in the group. There's always going to have to be somebody that's the youngest, you know, but we've seen now many, many cases of young players at the top level that go into the first team environment and they never come out. You know, I think it's getting less and less because it's such good work's been done within the academy to prepare them that, you know, go up because you're ready to go up and stay, but have your belief, you know, have, you know, if you want to call it ego, it's not a word that I like, but I know what you're saying, the ego can be perceived as being brash or being a bit big time, you know, but I do think that if you don't have that belief, if you don't believe, you know, you're not going to go up there and stay, you have to have that somewhere within your personality, even if you're an introvert type.
Yeah. Good one. Okay, back to you, Stephen, from Ricky here. Quite an interesting one, actually. How does a change in senior management impact the work that you do with younger players? And I suppose that's even more relevant for you trying to, as we spoke about earlier, trying to link between youth teams, reserve teams, and the first team he talks about here, for example, from Lennon or from Rogers into now Steve Lennon. So how does that senior management change impact the work you do? Does it impact?
It's a brilliant question, Greg, and I've had experience of that, obviously, at first hand, because obviously Brendan left and Neil came in. So did it have an impact on us as from the reserves down? Probably not, because of the, like I say, we'll speak about club philosophies, club models, game models. We've got that at our club. And it's something that through my own experiences, that young players need stability. They'll relish and they'll develop a lot quicker when there's stability from within that club. I think a first team manager is always going to change. It's always going to change. But I think below that, it's important that there's stability through the club. We've got that with Chris McCart, who's our academy director, who's been at the club for a long period of time. The positive side to both managers is that certainly Neil just now takes a keen interest in the games that we've played. And Brendan, before that, there was always the first team staff that would always come to games. There's always keeping a keen interest in how the reserve boys are doing and throughout the academy as well. And I think that's got to be consistent. I think even just younger players seeing that, whether it's the manager from the team above, like I said, if it's the under 16 coach who goes to the under 15s game, whether it's the academy director who's always there. Likewise, if it's a first team manager coming to watch your reserve games, it gives the young players a tremendous boost, knowing that the performances that they're putting in, they're getting recognition because the first team staff are there. And I think that's really important, Greg, at a football club. Mm-hmm. In our, like I say, the transitional phase with both managers at our club, it's not really had an effect on the club because we've got the club philosophy that's all the way through.
Yeah, super stuff. There's a question just in, Brian, I'm going to skip to from Andre. Wasn't one that was submitted earlier, but I think it's good for a good one for you. What's the most important characteristic for a young, talented athlete, in your opinion?
I think it's probably the same as a young candidate on a licence course that everyone's on just now. I think you've got to have a thirst for learning. I think every young player or every young athlete needs to want to get better, and the only way you can get better is if you've got this determination to learn, and that's where it all starts. Be you're a player or a coach, I don't think it makes any difference. So for me and every young player, we always look, before we select a player, we try and do background checks to see what their character's like, and we're genuinely wanting to find out, is there a young player there that wants to get better? And in order to get better, you've got to be willing to learn. So I think that's the biggest one.
Can you coerce someone if they don't naturally have that? Can you coerce them into that, do you think?
Yeah, I think that then goes back to us as coaches and the environment we set. Mm-hmm. I've been adamant, and I've debated this with loads of people. I think you, the coach who sets the tone in every session that you do, or you, the head of something that sets the environment for everybody to follow, if you can get that correct, I believe you can change a lot of people's minds to learning. It's how they learn is, for me, is the key. If they enjoy it, I genuinely believe that they want to learn.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of our responsibility. It's not just our knowledge. Our knowledge is only a little bit of it. So all the guys that's on the course just now, they've all got knowledge. They're sitting in this course. Mm-hmm. But it's how you can actually impact that knowledge onto the young players, knowing that, as I think a question that Steve got, there's going to be potentially 20 different characters in that changing room. Well, you maybe need to create slightly different environments for every single one of them in order for them to learn. And that's the hardest challenge for us.
Yeah, agreed. Steve, question from Eden. How do you mentally, you've talked earlier about butterflies, so it's not a bad one for you. You've talked about getting butterflies going back to Melbourne Victory. How do you mentally prepare for sessions you are doing? Are there any boxes in particular you try to tick? I think maybe the mental preparation, he's maybe talking about the planning and preparation, but also the mental psychology, I suppose, of what you're going through as a coach.
I like to think, Greg, that, you know, whatever session you're doing, obviously, you always list, and we've done it in previous courses, but certainly as a youth developer, you want to make, you know, the environment that, no matter what the theme is that you're working on, I always think that when you're in a youth development environment, you almost want that session to be personal to everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's challenging, because I always think that, you know, the best coaches, the youth coaches that I ever had, and I think back on it now, no matter what the session was, when they were speaking, it was almost like they were speaking to you. You know, and that's always kind of I've always tried to kind of stay with that when you're speaking to the players, the young players, before they go out, if you're in the analysis room, if you're trying to tell them what they're doing, you know, you need to, I don't like generic sessions. You know, I don't like on a Monday, this is the type of session, and on a Tuesday, it's this session. I think the whole thing has to evolve. There has to be a theme, but mm-hmm. each player, even if it's not in their position, i.e. you might be working on the back unit or the midfield unit, whoever's involved in that session almost thinks that it's a specific individual session for them. Uh-huh. And I think if you can get that as a coach, and you can connect with every one of those young men or ladies, I really think that's a proper youth development coach, that every day everybody's getting better.
Yeah, absolutely. One in from Carl here for you, Stephen. At what age would you look to make players position specific? Are you still trying people in different positions, even at reserve team level?
No, Greg, it's funny, because you always try and kind of revert back to your own experiences in questions like these. And what I will say is that I think your position ultimately picks the player. I think at a young age, it's important that we need to keep the boys loving the game. That's why they came into the game in the first place, because they love the game, they love the ball, they love participating in the game. So I think from a very young age, just let the boys get plenty of touches within the, let the players get plenty of touches of the football so that they keep engaged with the game. I think that's probably the most important thing. I think as their careers develop, once they get to 16, 17, I came in full-time at Celtic as a central midfield player. I then played over, I don't know how many games I played as a centre-back throughout my career. So I was late on in that way. So that's why, personally, I'm never in a rush to pigeonhole a certain young player into a position. But I think trust plays a big part on it, and the coaches as well, Greg. I really do, because I think young players must trust the eye of the coach and the eye of the coaches, because they can sometimes see certain things that maybe the player or the individual can't see at that particular time. And if you've earned that trust, the player, the coach then can over time see what position is going to suit that young player's attributes. And I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And again, it's going back to the relationship that Steve touched on between the coach and the players is crucial.
Yeah. That's decent points here from Stephen, Brian. I always think when I hear people discussing this type of question, I always think back to the midfield masterclass that we held. Yeah. I think about a year ago now, and Scott Brown, Darren Fletcher and Paul Scholes all admitted, I think, that they made their first team debuts in positions that they never played as academy players.
No, do you know what? I actually mentioned that yesterday, something that Paul Scholes mentioned. Remember when he was talking about when he was younger, he wasn't a holding midfield player. He was a midfield player, and he was coached to hold in midfield and to attack in midfield. And that was just the normal when you were brought up. And I think it's really, really important. I think, certainly, because on this course we talk about youth development, we are all youth developers. I think position-specific stuff, you need to be really careful on it. And I say that because, just like Stephen's alluding to there, you do not want to tie someone down a position too early. I think one of the big advantages that, and I'm seeing this, you know, at the programme that I'm involved in performance schools, is one of the main things we look for is to try and educate every player to play in every position on the pitch. And we'll do that within our structure. So if you're a right back, you will, at some point over the 4 years, get a brief outline of how a wide left player will play or a centre forward will play. And I think it's important as educators we give them that. And as they get slightly older, you then may become a little bit more specific on the information to that young player, which is fine. But I also think, and this is where we've changed in the last 12 months, if you're a right back and you want to start doing position-specific stuff for a right back, we believe now you should also think about the three areas of the pitch that he will find himself in, or she will find herself in. So yeah, we'll give you information for a right back, but the following week you're now going to get information of a right centre back, because that's where you'll find yourself in the game. You'll then get information as a centre midfield player, because you'll find yourself in there in the game. And then ultimately you'll find yourself as a right winger or a wide right player, because you'll find yourself in there in the game. So position specific almost becomes, as a minimum, you'll get your main position plus three others. And in some areas that's more. Yeah. Because if you're in the centre of the pitch, that's more. Yeah. But that's the kind of structure that we've tried to go on. We're just 12 months into it. But it's quite nice when I see Nathan Patterson make his debut for under 21s, and he's been a right back all his days. But we play him with wide right, and he's one of the best players on the pitch. And as a programme, I can look at that thinking, do you know what? I'm not saying we did it, but I know we certainly tried to influence that. And I know Rangers did, so... As Steve mentioned at the start, we take great satisfaction when we see that.
Steve, you must have some fantastic examples of kids that you've seen playing particular positions, but then making first-team debuts in positions that you maybe thought they could fit into maybe a bit better than they were more accustomed to.
Yeah, I've gave players their debut from inside the academy. There's two that springs to mind. One, when I was at Blackburn, when I was first team coach, then when I became manager, a young player, Jason Lowe, who was a central midfield player, playing for England under 21s at central midfield. And I just thought that there was two, he struggled a little bit with when there was a lot of traffic around him. And I thought if he could just walk onto the game, but he was good enough to play. So I played him at right back for his first 20 or 30 games. And then later on in his career, he moved into play in midfield once he could just keep on working on the attributes that was needed. But he started at right back, but he was a central midfield player. Phil Jones, when Phil came into the team, Phil was a centre-half, still is a centre-half, but came in and played as a holding midfield player. Just sat in front of centre-backs because we had club captain and club vice-captain as the two centre-backs. There was no space, so he sat in there. So I think if you go through a lot of young players, the first taste of first-team football is often out of position.
Yeah.
But they're good enough to be in the team, and some, you know, just getting them in somewhere. Sometimes then, you know, you can mould them into, you know, a player in that position. But ultimately, with experience, they go and they might get into a different position. But I just think that very much what Brian's saying, you know, if you only focus on one position, you're almost taking away. Not minimising, but you know, you're certainly not maximising their opportunity to get into the first team if they can only do one job.
Nah, fantastic. It's a wonderful topic of conversation. Moving on, though, Ross Peebles-Brown, Stephen Sitt, that's a question. Have you any advice or experience of managing and supporting a busy or over-involved parent, particularly of a player who has strong potential?
I've had a lot of experiences of that, and I've had different approaches to it, Greg. But again, it's going back to relationships, Greg. It's what's your core principles, what's your core values at the club as well. What's your principles as a person? How do you treat people? And certainly the way that as a club we always try and approach the situation as we try and show real humility, we try and show respect. And we try and speak to people in the way how it's the best way to do it. I think that's the best way to do it. We also need to understand that these parents are only interested in their own children, which is we've got absolutely no problem with, because in my own experiences, they care so much about their kid and their future. So I've got no problem with that whatsoever. But we still need to let them know when they come in to the football club, it's really important that the parents know what the parameters are, how far that they can go, but also what are the chances of success for these young players when they come in. I think that's important. They must know what the success rate is. They must know what the percentage is of the ones that don't become footballers. So I think that's why as a club, we always try and, when they come into the football club, can we develop the person and not just the player? Because when they leave our football club, whether it's for £25 million or whether it's they leave because it's maybe the right time, I think they want to do it and make sure that the experiences that they've had at the club has been unbelievably positive. And it's, again, how you conduct yourself on a daily basis. So that's what we kind of focus on. I think you need to manage certain situations in certain ways, and it's important that you try and read these situations, but you do it with the greatest humility and the greatest respect for the people that you can.
Yeah. Brian, you've almost had it as a youth coach, but not only that, it must be difficult. Parents wanting to get involved in selection, perhaps, for your performance schools as well. So you've maybe had a wee bit more experience of it that you could perhaps touch on.
I'll be honest, you know, Greg, it's like, I think as a parent wants as a parent, for a young player. Sorry?
As a parent yourself, you know, with your
young boys. Well, it's interesting. I've been a parent myself. I've had boys in academies. And as a parent, all I want to know is that my boy is getting the same opportunities as everyone else, or my boy is getting some time spent with them the same as everyone else. Now, I'm lucky enough we've had that. So I think as a coach, I think it's really, really important that when you're on a training pitch, for instance, and if you get 16 players in front of you, you may have 16 parents at the side watching the session. And all that parents looking for at that moment in time, I believe, is that you talk to their son or talk to their daughter. And I don't think that's hard as a coach. I think as a coach, it's really, really important that you should talk to every single player in your training session, not just the ones that you got on with, not just the ones that's got a bit of personality and a bit of character about them, because they're easy to talk to. It's the ones who that are quite shy in the corner that don't really want to mix with you, or it's the ones that may be feeling down because their form's dipped. Well, you've got to, as the head coach or the coach of that session, you've got to go and talk to them, and you've got to make sure after every session that you can look at the 16 players on the, and I'm saying 16, it could be more. Yeah. You've got to make sure that you spent time with every one of those players, because as a parent at the side, I think they're entitled to expect that. And if you've done that and you can do that in a consistent fashion, and that parent understands that you're there to try and help their boy or their girl, then I don't think they'll get anything to complain about. And I think that can help dealing with that situation that the question asked.
Yeah. Steve, I'm sticking with this one as well because I'm quite enjoying this one. But I think it was Chris Doig the other day when we were talking about dealing with parents with Donald McNaughton. Chris Doig started speaking about, you know, if you've been through a, let's say, an apprenticeship to be a plumber or a joiner, the parents not hanging about. But football's different in this sense, as Brian says. You know, the parents at the sideline watching everything that's going on.
I know, I agree with that. And I think sometimes it's maybe engaging with the parents. You know, we used to always, when I was at Fulham, we used to have a parents' day. The lads weren't there. We used to have it on a Sunday during an international break and bring the parents in. And it was basically an in-service on exactly what Brian's talking about, showing them that, listen, you know, your boys will get these amount of games. That will be guaranteed. Everybody's, you know, we've got no favourites. Every boy that's in the academies were favourites. They're going to have ups and downs. They're going to have growth spurts. They're going to have injuries. And I think we used to always try to say, on your journey home, you know, just try and let the coaches give the information. And the first questions from the parents should be after the game. Because it's normally after the game that the friction, if there is any, for me, it always happens is, what did the coach say? What did the coach say to you? And then I think then we were always looking then for the parents to edify the coach. You know, not you should have been playing more, you should have... So I think a bit of parent education, certainly within a youth development programme, I think goes a long, long way. And we even had it, you know, in one of the last courses, we had a candidate on who was one of my ex-players. And I always remember that was a tricky situation because they were from a different country. They were from New Zealand. They were in a faraway country. They were in London and they wanted so much for the boy. They were in a lot, and we had to say to them, listen, we can't accept you to come in more than the next parents. We're having our parents Sunday in 2 weeks. Come in and, you know, you'll get the same information as everybody else. And after that, they were great. So I think to answer the question, I think if you go to the parents, engage with them, show how their kids are going to be treated inside the academy, but especially please edify the coaches and trust the coaches, which Stephen's touched on.
Yeah, I think Stephen summed it up well and probably goes around that full circle of discussion there. You know, the core values and core principles that you touch on there are kind of reinforced almost, aren't they? So that everyone's going in the same direction. Good. Stick with you, Steve. There's a question here from Norbert, and he's asked it specifically of you, and good luck with this one. But what is more important, to reward or to sanction?
Oh, you know, that's probably we've got Steve Salas ringing in my ears. I think for me, it's always nice to dangle carrots. I'm not one for the stick. You know, I'm not one for, you know, punishing anybody or taking things away from anybody, but I always think that, you know, dangling the reward is always better than the fear of the stick. So obviously you've got to have rules, you've got to have, you know, a structure about the way that you run your youth development department, but I always think that, you know, if they stick to what the coaches are panning out for them, and, you know, sitting there saying, well, if you want to get to this next level, let's work together, this is what you've got to do, and that carrot's dangling at the end, if you do that, you're going to be at that level, then that's only one step away for the first team or two steps away for the first team. So I would always go with a reward and a carrot dangled rather than if you don't do this, this is going to happen. You know, I'm not a believer in that type of management, even at youth development level.
Yeah, it's positive. It's positive reinforcement, hopefully. Okay, moving on. Question from Paul Gregg to you, Stephen. Culture. This one's about culture. What type of culture do you try to create within your team or club? And how do you go about implementing that? Is that set from the academy director, maybe perhaps rather than yourself? Or can you implement one specifically for your own team?
I think it's a collective point, Greg, if I'm being honest. I think, like you said, we are, as coaches, we are just one part of the collective unit at our academy, which is everybody swimming in the same direction, everybody's trying to create the same thing, which is, and I think this is really important in youth development and working at a football club, Greg, where ultimately, what does the manager want? What does he want from the academy? Whoever's in charge of the football club at that time, what is he looking for? Because we can have the best academy structure in the world with the best culture, with the best environment. And if you've not got somebody at the top of that who's willing to put the young players in, I think it's going to be very challenging. And we've been really lucky over the last, God, I don't know how many years, we've even gone back to Martin O'Neill's era where the managers at our club have been very, very good at putting the young players in, because young players just need an opportunity. We try and create a culture at our club of, can the young players work as hard as they possibly can when there's nobody standing over watching them? I think if you can do that and the players work as hard as they possibly can when nobody's watching, you're onto a good thing. Brian touched on it earlier, Greg, about who sets the standards. I'm in total agreement with Brian in regards to, I think, the coaches that are taking that team. You've got the framework from within the club philosophy, but your main leaders of that group set the tone. You set the standards every day and how you prepare your session, how your session flows, how you manage your people within that. Can we find out how the young players will be going through? A lot of them will be going through their first girlfriend, their first time driving a car, maybe their first house that they buy. So these relationships are also extremely important. We need to know how these boys are coming into training on a daily basis. And I think that forms the whole culture of your club as well, along with the hard work, along with the dedication, the application. I would say the main part of it, for me, if you want to be a top young player, the young players must have resilience. They must be able to deal with adversity.
How do you balance that, Brian? We always say that they need to deal with adversity, don't we? But, you know, how do you, maybe particularly in your performance school environment, how do you give them that adversity? How do you give them the speed bumps in the road that are going to help them develop?
It's probably one of the fine balances, Greg, to be honest. It's the only way, and that speed bump is going to be different from every single player, but and the only way that you can be confident doing that is if you really get to know the young person. So, you know, you could put a speed bump in at age 13 or you might need to wait to age 23. And it's really, really hard. But I'll be honest, come back to Stephen talking about culture there. If you can set the culture correct, and the only way you know your culture is correct is if you ask the players. You know, people go on about culture all the time. My culture is this, my culture is that, or my club's culture is this and that. But you need to ask the people actually that are meant that live in it and grow up in it, what they think of it. But if they're living in, if they grow up in a culture that they believe in, which then means they do believe the coach and they do believe this pathway is there for them, then you can set speed bumps. And then the culture that will surround them will support them in the speed bump and then push them on. And then you've got a really, really strong culture then and a real strong environment which will help you when you put the bumps into place. But you need to put them in. If everyone talks, and Stephen's mentioned it, everyone talks about how important resilience is, well, you're going to have to put it in then. If it's so, so important, you need to put it in. It's just a matter of finding out where and when. In terms of the performance schools, it's challenging for us because we don't play it every weekend. So I think some people use the weekend game to put the speed bump in. We don't. We probably, our first real chance of doing that is when we pick national squads. And it's really, really important then that our head coaches understand the national squad is about to be named. And there'll be certain players at that moment in time will feel really disappointed. And then that's when the coach has got to come alive, because that's when he can turn that negative into a huge positive and then really, really improve the learning, improve the training, improve the kids' chances, because you do need it. Yeah. You do need it.
Yeah. But when you talk about setting culture there as well, Brian, I know, for example, the performance school head coaches, you lock them away for 2 or 3 days at a time and you'll discuss many a thing. And I'm sure one thing and amongst that is how you set that culture for, you know, for the national programme.
Yeah, it's massive for us. Like I said, as head of the programme, I don't need to go and visit the school every day. I don't need to go and watch sessions every single day because myself and the 7 head coaches have built the culture. So we all believe in it, first of all. So it's much easier then to man it. But every single year, we ask the players how they feel about it. And we don't do that ourselves. We do that when an independent person comes in and does it. Mm-hmm. That was really hard at the start. Because they're asked direct questions. You know, what do you think of the coach? And we don't know what they're saying. Because it's really, really important that we have that. But we want to know what they feel about the 7 schools. Yeah. Because that's the only way we know as coaches whether we can do anything about the culture. If you ask the players that's in it. And ultimately, you ask the players that's leaving it. So when they leave it or when they've left it 2 or 3 years, we still ask them, what was your experiences in the school? How can we make it better? How can we do this? How can we do that? But when you do that, you're leaving yourself really, really open. But I don't think that's a bad thing at times. You've got to leave yourself vulnerable to try and make your programme better or make your culture better.
Yep. Top stuff. Good. Last question from Ross Fawcett, Steve. And I'll skip his first part of it and jump on his second part. Do you show or do you display different characteristics from training than you do in games when you're working with youth players?
No, I don't think so. I think you have to have consistent behaviour. You know, I think you put on the sessions, you're training, and then ultimately there's goals for each player. It's not just about winning a game, you know, but. So I think your behaviour has to be consistent. That you know you're setting out a framework during the week, and the players are taking that on. They're learning. They're all learning individually, and then okay that they've all got their different aspects, and then that's just how did you do? You're put out on a Saturday or a Sunday, whenever it is, at youth level, and then it's about then sitting down and analysing it individually with the players. How did you do? So I think your behaviour has to be consistent and you have to be so individual, you know, and you can't be shouting on something during a game that you haven't worked on and haven't asked the player to do just because it's a game. I think you as a youth coach, you have to be measured and you have to be asking them to deliver on what they have worked on and what you and the player have set out to as a task. As a you know an improvement as their next thing that they have to work on, so I would like to think that as a youth developer your behaviour is consistent day to day, week to week, and certainly weekday to game day.
No, it certainly helps your authenticity I think throughout that. Okay, final question then. I'll take the first part of Rossi's question now, and the one I always like to finish with, and you know it's about the guys that are, you know, listening in as part of this course. But Ross has also asked, what's the most important characteristic you think for a youth coach? And I'll add into that, and can you give a little bit of advice just to finish us off? So most important characteristic and that little bit of advice, Stephen.
I really like the part that Brian went and spoke about earlier, about having a real thirst for knowledge and a real willingness to always looking to improve. And again, what I would say is get to know the young players. That's really important. Get to know them as people and not just as how they perform in the training pitch. Can you build that relationship? Because you want them in 5 years' time, in 10 years' time, still be in a position where they can pick up the phone to you and look for that wee bit of advice. I think if you can manage that, you know you've cracked it with the relationships. And I think if you continue to read as much books as you possibly can, build your network as often as you can, go and see best practice, go and see different coaches to see what the current trends are. And I think if you can do that, then you'll be well on your way to becoming the best coach that you can possibly be.
Super stuff, Stephen. Brian?
I think patience has become a big one for me in youth development. department. I think now there's an incredible amount of peer pressure out there. You know, we're all on social media. We're all watching this coach does this, this coach is doing that. And at times, as a youth developer, you'll be thinking, oh, I better do this or I better do that. And I think we need to be careful of that. I think we shouldn't be in a rush to give the players too much too quickly. We should be going a little bit more slow and making sure they're doing it more, making sure they're doing it properly rather than just try to do it quick. I think that's really, really key. And in order to have that patience, then you've got to have confidence in your own ability, I think, you know. So confidence in your own ability should then give you the patience with young players and allow them to develop in their own pace rather than trying to get everyone to develop quick. Forget about that. Let's just try and develop properly. So that would be my bit.
Fantastic. Last but not least, Steve.
I think probably for me, Greg, the biggest thing, you know, when you're dealing with young players and being a good youth coach is making that connection, you know, that Stephen spoke about, you know, Steve Salas spoke about, making that connection and actually making the player see. It's only done by, you know, letting them see you in your most, you know, stripped back, natural, vulnerable place that you're working for them to try and make them a player. You know, you know, I think you have to treat everybody the same. I don't think as a youth developer you can have any favourites that I'm trying to push you so that you're a number, and that means that we've got one guy. I think you've got to treat everybody the same. And if the young players feel that everybody's got the same chance as the next person, and that you're genuine to each one of them, and you work for them to try and get them that pro contract or that scholarship or that, you know, involvement with the first team. I think if they feel that, and it's a feeling that they have to have, and I think it's a soft skill. I think my advice to the coaches that are on the course is obviously take everything from the course and work on your soft skills, because if you can make that connection and that the players can actually feel that you're with them, I think they always surprise you and they go way above expectation.
Yeah. Ryan, I'm going to skip to you for a final word, because it just amazes me every single course we do and when we're working together, and the more I've been around pro licences and A licences, but I ask that question at the end of every course and nobody talks about tactical knowledge. Nobody talks about having tactical insights and being a genius at balancing a back four or being able to play through the thirds. Why?
I think, look, the most important thing in coaching is how you connect. That's it. You know, if all the knowledge in my head of the best back four, and I know everything in my head of what a back four should do, but there's no point in it being in my head when it needs to be in the head of the four players that's in the back four. Mm. So you've got to somehow get it from your head to their head. And if that takes you 1 week, it takes you 1 week. If that takes you 10 years, it takes you 10 years. But you've got to try and do it. And I still believe the best way of doing that, and the best way is without doubt, if that young kid and you can build the connection. And but that's it. I say young kid, I take that back. That's at any age. That can be at 13, that could be age 33. If the coach connects with the player and the player connects with the coach, then you can maximise learning to another level, which you probably never thought was possible. And it's all to do with the human connection. And I can't stress to all the guys that's listening on it just now, Steve's mentioned it, Stephen's mentioned it, it's the biggest part in football development. The biggest part is how you and a young player or an old player can kind of connect and have a conversation.
Super. A fantastic end, a fantastic hour, guys. Thank you very much for your time. Stephen, thank you. Brian and Steve, thank you very much, guys.
That's all we have time for in this week's edition of the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast. Feel free to send us your feedback, your ideas for coaching topics you want us to cover, and to get in touch, visit @ScottishFA on Twitter or email info@scottishfa.co.uk.